Sir Donald McQueen, bibliographer. Chapter 4, Fisticuffs on the Steps of the British Museum.
Aware, my name is Donald McQueen, and I am a bibliographer. For some years now, I have been studying the Codex Asinorum, and it is high time I told you a little more of that great and enduring mystery. It is a recondite one, which no common understanding can encompass, but I will tell you anyway. The text was written by Scrutus, a 13th century monk and Gnostic, and circulated in Europe in manuscript until the middle of the 15th century. What is written in the book is of no importance, though it is generally held to be hilarious. The mystery concerns its first printing, in an edition believed to have been created by that famous proto-typographer Crispus Rossfleisch himself, or perhaps by his slightly less well-known brother Jimbo. It was realized around the turn of the last century that the edition existed not in a single impression, but in multiple printings, upon 7 different papers, each manufactured in a different period, as well as upon parchment, dogskin, pink pillowcases, yellow pillowcases, and slices of well-aged pecorino, specially imported from Italy by mule train over the Alps. Some years ago, Peter Pinkelman of Princeton came up with the theory that the first edition of the Codex was not printed at all, but was manufactured using a large number of stencils pierced with punches. This could explain how precisely the same text could appear on all these different substrates over the course of several decades. But Pinkelman's theory was ridiculed by some. The leader of the anti-stencilites was Flora Van Driver of the British Library. When Pinkelman came to London for a conference, Flora taught as many of the street urchins of the city as she could find to sing a facetious rhyme she had written, which ran as follows. Anyone with any sensil, never let his theory pass. Anyone who is not densil, rate his theory second class, and his pride, although immensal, shatter like a sheet of glass. When we stick his bloody stencil up his stupid Princeton ass. The children took to this rhyme and sang it around the streets of London for many years, though I doubt many of them understood it. The ditty certainly had an intimidating effect upon Pinkelman. When he arrived at Senate House, he found he had to enter the building via a path lined with urchins, all singing the stencil song and waving little pennants which Flora had supplied, bearing Pinkelman's face with a dunce's cap added, and the witty caption, Pinkelman the Simpleton, printed across the brow. Peter had his revenge, however, 2 years later, when Van Driver and a team from the British Library came to Princeton for a colloquium on the subject of flong. Pinkelman hired the Whiffenpoofs from Yale to sing a charivari under Flora's hotel window that night. They were all dressed as ganglions, in costumes supplied by Pinkelman. He had written new words to the Whiffenpoof song, which he paid them a large sum to sing repeatedly for 2 hours without ceasing. He added to the insult by making a recording of their rendition and issuing it as a single. It hardly troubled the hit parade, of course, but was heard by many bibliographers and librarians around the world. By good fortune, I have it on my iGramophone at this moment. Listen to this.
From the reading rooms at Princeton to the pubs of London town, in Oxford's lofty halls where thinkers think, bibliographers assembled regard her with a frown, for her theories all are balls and balls that stink. Out of logic that's unsteady, and with evidence that's weak, she'll construct a monstrous clerken out of gas. She will make her study ready. She will draw her breath to speak. Then she'll fart and hope we'll hearken to her ass. We are Flora's brain cells, which have lost their way. Blah, blah, blah. We are wisdom and truth which have gone astray. Blah, blah, blah. Ludicrous notions wandering free, naught but windy hyperbole, naught but flatus as wise men see. Blah, blah, blah. Odorous wind of the worst degree, thunderous blasts from the lavatory. No one listens to such as she. Blah, blah, blah.
The disagreement came to a head in London some 20 years ago when the two chief protagonists met by chance on the steps of the British Museum. The result was fisticuffs. Although Pinkelman had the obvious advantages of height, weight, age, and arguably sex, Flora had a spanner in her handbag with which she felled her opponent with a single blow, taking out three of his teeth in the process. There the argument rested until I took the matter up and began to investigate the mystery. There is more. Not only is the first edition of the Codex Asinorum mysterious, but the first English edition, the Book of Arses of 1501, is, if anything, still more so. Who translated it? Who printed it? Where and when? Despite the colophon date of 1501, there are strong grounds to suspect that the printing was begun earlier and completed later. It has occurred to me, of course, that I have an advantage over all other men and women and superhuman bibliographers, including Pinkelman and Van Driver, in that I possess the ear trumpet of death. Could I not listen in to Ross Fleisch or his brother Jimbo at work in Mainz before the sack of 1462? Could I not hear the English edition in preparation in Westminster in the 1490s? It seemed to me that all of this should be possible, and yet, so far, my attempts to direct the trumpet to the right time and place have failed. The closest I have come is to a laundry in Eltville, around 1470, where an obscure relative of Ross Fleisch fell foul of the local laws on keeping munchkins, and to the home of a London merchant who was surprised in 1486 to catch his wife in bed with the charming time-traveller we know as Bernard Cribbins. In another age and with another name, he was enrolled at Timor Mortis, but that is another story. I had suspicions that the ear trumpet of death had powers even greater than those I had so far mastered, or failed to master, and that it must, in time, aid me in my pursuit of the truth regarding the Codex Asinorum. I determined there and then to try to eavesdrop again upon the creation of the first printed edition of that infuriating volume, and thrust the trumpet into my ear. But I found myself almost as far away in time and space from 15th century Mainz as it was possible to be. I was in my own college last week. I recognised the ticking of the great clock known as Kronos, the Devourer of Youth, which has stood in the junior common room since 1896. It is a most curious timepiece, which ticks by design once every 3.5 seconds. Here I was privy to an extraordinary scene between one of the stone brows of the college and a trickster whom I could not help but admire.
Wow. Where did you come from?
I came from Cambridge, young sir.
Wow. And how did you get in here? There's supposed to be, like, security and stuff.
I entered by magic.
Wow.
Am I right in thinking that I'm addressing Tobias, known as Toby, Bernard Charles Windsor Gascoigne?
You certainly are. And who are you?
I, sir, am Professor Diogenes Swift of Cambridge and of Cloud City University in the sky.
Fantastic.
I regret to say that I have bad news for you, Toby.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh, indeed. Do you know Michael Bracewell Balls of Windrush College?
Don't know the guy? Didn't even know there was, like, a Windrush College.
Well, Michael Bracewell Balls is telling all his friends that you are an idiot.
Really?
Are you familiar with Beth Whoopsie Daisy of Ray Winston Hall?
No, don't know Beth.
Beth is also telling everyone she knows that you are an idiot.
No.
Yes. And do you know Jean-Marie Cordian of this very college?
Certainly do. Don't tell me Jean Marie is telling everyone I'm an idiot too.
No. Jean-Marie Cordian is telling all his friends that you are an imbecile. And an idiot.
But I'm not an idiot. Or an imbecile.
I know that. But how will anyone else know it?
Well, I'm like a student here at Knoxford University. That proves I'm not fake.
Ah, such innocence. Look around you, sir. Look at the lolling mouths and dull eyes of your fellows, and even some of your professors. They are, some of them, barely conscious, barely sentient. They have so little gorm that to call them gormless would be a gross overestimate of their levels of gorm. They are in a constant state of negative gorm. So you see, being a student at Knoxford proves nothing.
But I am not a thicky.
I know it, and you know it, but how will anyone else know it? I can help you, Toby.
Really?
Oh, yes. I am Professor Diogenes Swift of Cambridge and of Cloud City University in the sky. And I am prepared to sign a certificate to certify that you are not an idiot, but in fact an intelligent man. For the modest consideration of £149.99, I will write your name on this certificate, crafted by the greatest living printer of our age and printed on the finest parchment paper, and sign it to prove your lack of idiocy.
How much did you say?
£149.99.
That seems rather a lot.
A lot? What price wisdom? What price your reputation? Once I have completed the certificate and presented it to you, no one will ever again be able to call you an idiot. If they do, you can reply, no, I am not an idiot, for I have a certificate signed by Professor Diogenes Swift of Cambridge and of Cloud City University. In the sky, to prove it.
Do you, like, take plastic?
I accept every species of credit and debit card known to man, not just the major ones.
Coutts Gold Card?
Most certainly. Simply bring it close to this little Ormolu box. There is no need to touch it. The box is magic and contactless.
Top man.
That's all that's necessary. Now I will complete and sign the certificate. Toby, you have made a wise decision this day. Now tell me, Toby, you perchance know Rachel Bridgeforth Fordingbridge of this college?
Rachel? Oh, yeah.
Do you know what people are saying about Rachel, Toby? People are saying that Rachel is an idiot.
Well, to be fair, she is a bit of an idiot.
I do not agree, Toby. I do not agree.
Once again, my ears were drawn through the trumpet away from one extraordinary world and into another. The magical, alchemical world of the wireless.
And now on BBC Radio Knoxford, the fourth and final episode in our series of Victorian Tales of Terror. The Count has fragranced his way into the heart of the beautiful Lucy Honeypot, who has left her former fiancé, dull but worthy attorney Anthony Plumstring, broken-hearted and out for revenge. After dogging the couple across London, Plumstring is at last rewarded when the Count appears to have made a fatal error. Find out what that error was, and whether the attorney can win back the heart of Miss Honeypot, in this final episode of Count Flatula, a Vampire with a Problem. Count Flatula by Abraham Stoker. Starring Featherston Crumbleback and Simon Callow III.
Extract from
from the prison journal of Count Vladislaw Fletula, 29th December, 1888. I have been the luckiest and the happiest of blood-drinking Transylvanian noblemen, for I have known the laugh and the bustle of Miss Lucy Honeypot, albeit that laugh and that bustle are lost to me now. For 3 months I lived in bliss, and so, of course, did Lucy, as we shared the delicious cloud of my internal gases. We loved as no two humans have ever loved before, I should think, and ascended to the highest peak of ecstasy on a cloud of wonderful perfume. But even for a blessed count, such ecstasy could not endure. I knew it all too well. Our idyll ended suddenly and in the following manner. I had booked a table at the best restaurant in London town, Fiddleditch's Chop House. For that evening, I intended to offer Lucy the highest prize any woman could crave, the hand of a count, and the title Countess. We sat together in the deserted room, two richly braided and bewigged waiters tending to our every whim. I asked one of the waiters for some pastis, but he soon returned with a couple of Cornish pasties. I have lost every trace of my Transylvanian accent, and had pronounced the order perfectly, so that his mistake would only have been the act of an imbecile. In a fit of rage, I killed the waiter and drank his blood. Well, I wondered, as soon as I had done it, if I had perhaps made an error of judgment. I looked at Lucy, but she seemed not to have seen or understood what I had done. She had eyes only for her beloved count. I knew then the strength of my power over her, and felt for a moment that I could have done anything, committed any monstrous act, or said some really naughty words, without making the faintest scratch in her regard for me. I thought I was safe. The second waiter came to the table and obsequiously removed the body of his companion. He too seemed to be under the influence of my loveliness. Lucy smiled. I looked round. We were alone in the place. Our pastis arrived, and I ordered oysters for us both, and a very rare steak for myself, along with a bottle of that delicious blood-red sauce manufactured by Schickel's Pickles. Then, to my utter amazement, 3 men entered the room, all with handkerchiefs, which I later learned were soaked in vinegar, over their mouths and noses. 2 were policemen, and the 3rd I soon recognized as the dullard Anthony Plumstring.
"There he is!" cried Plumstring. "I saw him kill a waiter with my own eyes!"
It seemed he had observed my careless anger and its outcome through the little round window in the door of the restaurant. I protested my innocence, and so did Lucy. But then the living waiter returned with his dead brother in his arms, the effects of the perfume having temporarily worn off when he got into the kitchen. I was arrested by one of the policemen and put into handcuffs, despite the other policeman, who was not so assiduous with his hanky, now being convinced that I was a prince among men and could not have committed such an act.
The waiter, too, now re-intoxicated, proclaimed my innocence, and even confessed to having killed the dead man himself for no very obvious reason. But Plumstring and the first policeman were determined and sufficiently immune to my power that I was taken from the place into a waiting carriage and thence to the cells at Newgate. I have seen no one, and of course my foul odours have returned, and my power to make men and women love me is lost. Indeed, it is worse than that, for my power now is to make men and women recoil and retch in horror at my stench.
Extract from the Journal of Anthony Plumstring, Attorney at Law, Pimlico, 25th February 1889. The vile creature known as Flatula was tried at the Old Bailey, convicted of the murder of Giuseppe Nicotini, a stereotyped Italian waiter, and sentenced to be hanged. I was the chief witness for the prosecution, but the other waiter and the two policemen who were involved in the case were also called to give evidence. Even Lucy was made to testify. She bore it with great dignity, and recalled all the details of Flatula's crime perfectly, confessing, as did the waiter and one of the policemen, that she had been under his spell at the time, so that he had seemed to be acting with great kindness and propriety to Nicotini, a man she described as clearly a massive idiot. The count, too, bore himself with dignity, or as much as he could muster, given that he was unable to control the wind that broke from his person every few seconds and suffused the air with an odour best characterised as hellish. The judge ordered 7 incense burners to be brought into the court and placed around the dock, and the double doors to be opened, and 9 serving maids to stand between him and the count with large fans to waft his gases out of the courtroom, but to no avail. The count was doomed. Not only was the evidence strong against him, but the smell was strong too, and when he opened his great flap-like mouth to defend himself, his accent too was strong. No English jury would acquit a man so obviously guilty, malodorous, and foreign. I confess that, for all his misdeeds, for all his foulness and foreignness, there was a part of me that pitied the creature, and so I visited him in his cell on the day before he was fated to take that last short walk to the gallows.
Oi, Count, you've got a visitor.
Is it you, Lucy? Ah, no. Anthony Plumstring, attorney at law of Pimlico, I see. Have you come to gloat over my humiliation?
No, Count. I have come to say farewell. My God, you stink.
Regrettably, I do. It is my true odor, not the false sweet scent which made me the laugh object of so many men and women, including, I believe, your own beloved, the divine Lucy Honeypot.
Reminding me of that, sir, is not the act of a gentleman.
I am no gentleman, Plumstring. I am a nobleman.
Soon you will be a late nobleman.
As I say, you come to gloat.
No, indeed. I come to ask after your comfort. Is your cell tolerable?
It is, as you see, magnificent.
And is your warder kindly?
I am afraid not. He shows me no respect. He mocks my accent. He repeats that I sound to him like a Belgian. Had I the power, I would kill him and drink his blood.
I am content that you have not the power. But here I have for you a parting gift. It is a small thing, but may bring some comfort. It is in this cigar box.
What is it?
It is a steak. A very rare one.
Ah!
No, no, do not eat it now. Save it for tomorrow's breakfast. That way, when you face the executioner, you will be fragrant once more and able to meet your maker with some dignity.
I thank you for this kindness, Mr. Dullard Plumstring.
Do not believe it will help you to escape your fate, for all the warders and the hangman will be warned to guard against your charms in the morning. The gallows awaits, but you may perhaps mount it in a cloud of perfume rather than of sewer breath. And now, I will not say farewell, for I know you can only fare ill. I say instead, hasta la vista. No, that is not right. The proper valediction escapes me. Perhaps I should merely say, see ya. Wouldn't want to be ya.
See you, and I would not want to be you either, Plumstring. But I thank you for this day.
Extract from the... oh, who cares? The Count was hanged the next morning, and his body buried in unconsecrated ground. I could not attend the event myself, as public hangings had, quite disgracefully, been discontinued some 20 years previously by an administration which was, I regret to say, both soft on vampirism and soft on the causes of vampirism. The public deserved, and would have enjoyed, to see the Count's end. But I was told he died with dignity, surrounded by sweetness, and had to be content with that. His miserable life was over, and mine could begin again, with Lucy at my side. Or so I thought. But when I took her hand, and attempted to adjust her bustle, as I had once done in our most intimate moments, she drew away from me, and declared that we could never again be intimate in that way. I asked her why, and she replied that, loved once by a hemophagiac, she could never go back. The Count had, despite his unfortunate habit of killing prostitutes and drinking their blood, shown her a world of sensual love, of wealth and noble privilege, and enchanted her with such magic as she had never known, and could not know, in the arms of a humble attorney at law, of Pimlico. I was heartbroken, but I had no choice in the matter. Lucy departed from me, and began to wander the mountains of Europe, seeking a new lover among the noblemen of those countries where cheese, and goats, and rough beer, and ridiculous dances may be found in profusion, while I returned to Pimlico, and sadly took up my position as an attorney at law once more. A week later, I had a terrible dream in which I saw the Count again. He was not dead, and had escaped his grave by some sweet-scented magic, and returned to wreak revenge upon his enemies. And when I woke, with the perfume of the dream still in my nostrils, I knew it to be true.
The final episode of Count Flatula, a vampire with a problem. The part of the Count was played by Featherston Crumbleback, and Anthony Plumstring by Simon Callow III. Mr. Callow is currently appearing in Punch and Judy, The Crocodile's Revenge, at the revived Gaiety Theatre. Have you been affected by the issues raised by Count Flatula? Have you felt a compulsion to kill prostitutes and drink their blood? Have the affections of your betrothed been alienated by a foreign nobleman? Have you had difficulty obtaining steak from Waitrose or an artisan butcher? If so, you can ring the BBC's euphemism line on 20207252111. Calls are answered by robots, programmed with a mild curiosity and a profound understanding of the concept of privacy.
This was no good at all. I had spent more than a week listening to the wonders of the ear trumpet and had got no closer to an understanding of the mystery of the Codex Asinorum. I made up my mind, there and then, to leave Knoxford and the bewitching trumpet behind for a few days after I had dined that evening, and to spend some time at my club in London, where, I hoped, I might be able to concentrate again on the great problem which lay before me. That was The Adventures of Donald McQueen. Bibliographer. Today's chapter was sponsored by the Bibliographical Society of London and by Schickel's Pickles, manufacturers of the finest tomato ketchup in the world. It was written and performed by Paul W. Nash. The Whiffenpoof song is by Todd Galloway. Next time in The Adventures of Donald McQueen, Bibliographer.
Come quick, Mr. Holmes. I saw him, sir, up them stairs, underneath a big woman. No, Wiggins, that is not Moriarty. I told you to look out for a man who resembled our beloved queen, but with side whiskers.
By sheer coincidence, I'm thinking of Her Majesty at this very moment.
Damn you, sir! That is treason!
Mm-hmm.